This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're revisiting the theme of mental health in the workplace as part of our two-part mini-series. I've got loads of stats, and first off, I've got some from Rethink Mental Illness. They found 68% of people who can hire staff would worry about someone with severe mental illness that they wouldn't fit in with the team. As someone who is an employer myself, that one makes me incredibly sad. First of all, it's just plain wrong. As someone that's hired an incredibly diverse range of people in all possible mediums, including working with a team who've experienced mental illness, that just really upsets me.
But on the other hand, they're worried that they would be uncomfortable, it would be too much for them. And it's sort of more from a position of care or worry, or, you know, I'm trying to sort of think the best of most people and try and put it in a frame of no malice intended, you know. But on the other hand, if you're running a department that would be too intense, or you're running a team that are too full on for somebody that doesn't fit into a specific neurotypical mold, then you really have to examine what the role and what the team dynamic is. So I think that's interesting that that number is so high, but right. I wonder how much of that percentage are more out of a position of care than they are of like, oh no, we don't want them here. Does that make sense?
It does and it doesn't. I understand what you mean in that it would have to be a pretty extreme workplace for it to be that niche on who would fit in there. Yeah,
it just makes me sad that that number's so high, and I'm trying to explain it away.
I get that, and I get that you're trying to be sympathetic. This one, it just makes me sad. It just makes me angry, because I stand by the point that very few workplaces would be unsuitable for somebody with a mental illness. And actually, those that are, I think, are quite toxic anyway. Like, I wouldn't wish working on the stock exchange doing 20-hour night shifts on anybody. I don't think that's healthy for anyone.
Yeah, let's change that.
So I think if there's a workplace like that, that's a bigger problem. For the vast majority of workplaces, they, first of all, are going to be fine for people with mental illness, because we're just normal people. We just have an additional thing on our plate, as many people do. Many people have childcare to deal with. Many people have a job that means they have an unusual sleep pattern. Many people have massive commutes. We all have factors that can make work more or less difficult. But none of those should invalidate a good employer taking you on. And so as much as you can say that maybe it's out of care, that they wouldn't want to put someone in a team where they don't fit in, how can you care about someone by discriminating against them? How can you think, I care about this person, therefore I'm not going to give them a job? That seems ironic to me.
Well, then I definitely hear and appreciate that. But then I wonder if the reason that there's such a high percentage number of people who feel that way, it's to do with the stigma that surrounds mental health, and those people believe that mental health issues mean that you can't cope in an average day-to-day workplace.
Exactly. That's what it is. It's the stigma and the ignorance. Because ultimately, if you're hiring in any business of a certain size, you have people in that business who have experienced mental illness by default, because it's so common. And therefore, it creates two problems. It creates a problem of discrimination that people, if they do disclose things, or if, let's say, they've had time out of work to deal with improving their mental health, then they can be discriminated against. But also it contributes to the stigma, because then people aren't going to disclose in an interview setting. And I know that a big moment for me was the first time I got a job where I mentioned having a mental health podcast. It was only, you know, temporary job whilst working in Edinburgh. So I don't know if maybe that changes the parameters, but I'm delighted that I felt comfortable mentioning doing a mental health podcast and drawing on my own experience of mental illness to inform the show in an interview setting. I know that's something that I wouldn't have always felt comfortable talking about.
Yeah, I agree. Sorry, I did it on mute again. Sorry. I agree with everything that you've said. That makes perfect sense. I've had similar experiences myself. So, it just shows that it's a really universal experience.
Mm-hmm. We've sort of touched on this a little bit as well, but also from Rethink, 83% of the same hiring capable staff would worry that somebody with a severe mental illness wouldn't be able to cope with the demands of the job. And again, that's something which is important to, I think, object to is the best way I have to phrase it, because absolutely people can handle mental illness and a job. In fact, most people do. Of course, there's some conditions and some severities of it where that can become a problem, but it's not binary like anything.
Yeah, I do. Like, I know heaps of friends who hold down full-time jobs while successfully managing their mental illness, thanks to medication, self-care, podcasts like this one, selfish little plug there. Like, I think that it's really important, because occupational health departments exist within jobs for this reason. So when I started my job, I had a really long phone call with occupational health, because obviously they wanted to make sure that teaching role for somebody with depression and fibromyalgia was going to be safe. And luckily, I'm really well managed, so it is. But I think that if the government is putting people as fit to work with really severe mental health conditions, then government and corporations and businesses need to work together, and it shouldn't fall on the shoulders of the individual to manage their own mental health all by themselves. I think that if that is something that the government is saying, yes, you're okay to work, then they also need to be supporting employers in, you know, hiring, so they can be the most sensitive and they can be the most inclusive.
Yep, absolutely. And if anyone doesn't think that the government is saying this, I actually have a quote that's going to go on our Instagram from Theresa May.
Ooh, gimme.
Who said, many employers are already creating healthy, inclusive workplaces, but more needs to be done so that employers provide the support needed for employees with mental health conditions. So there's an example of how, as much as the stigma exists right at the top of government, there is some understanding, not enough, but some understanding of the need for better support for mental health in the workplace. Following on from what we've been talking about in terms of it being absolutely possible to work and experience mental illness and that be perfectly safe and normal and in fact is completely common, I've got another statistic from Rethink. They found only 43% of all people with mental health problems are in employment, compared to 74% of the general population. For some conditions, the employment rate is even lower, so 8% of people with schizophrenia are currently in work. So I know there's quite a few stats within that I've just read out, but I think this really highlights, first of all, the problem of discrimination, that it's 43% of people with mental health problems, as in they're currently going through them, are in employment compared to 74% of the general population who aren't. So that one's really important because it's an example of how the discrimination works in real terms. However, it should also be noted that some of those people will be voluntarily taking time out of work to support their mental health. And both of those statistics include people that are retired, are traveling, are studying. And so actually, luckily, both statistics are higher when you include people who aren't of work age or aren't looking for work.
Sure. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. You're much better at the maths than I am.
I try. But then I think the other one that's really important to highlight is 8% of people with schizophrenia are currently in work. That is an example of a condition that for many people, it's really severe
and really debilitating.
So that's one where it is disproportionately high in the unemployment. But then that is a condition that for many, they aren't able to work. And so that's, luckily, that's not all down to discrimination. But it does show, to me anyway, how certain conditions that are more severe are also more commonly discriminated against. And to prove that point, I have another statistic. So a survey also from Rethink of 500 people with hiring responsibilities found that 54% of bosses wouldn't know how to support someone with a severe mental health condition like schizophrenia at work.
Yeah, wow.
And so I think there's really a direct link there between there's the lack of understanding. The stigma can also so often lead people to believe that schizophrenia is somehow far more dangerous to others than it actually is.
Sure.
It's very much an internal experience that whilst people
yeah.
can lash out, that's very uncommon. And so that's a clear sign to me that a big part of this is education. Which
yeah,
so much of what we talk about comes back to education.
Yeah, it's the same as with our petition though, isn't it? Like quite a lot of teachers probably don't know how to support one of their students with a mental health condition or a mental health concern because they haven't received the training. It doesn't mean they don't want to. It's just they don't know how to because they've never been taught.
And so often, like we've discussed in this mini series, people use that as a reason to stay away. They're like,
yeah.
I don't understand it. So if I ask a question, I'm going to open a can of worms. But actually, so often, the resources are all there. You just need to have some basic understanding of what resources you could direct somebody to. And you just need to have a workplace culture where it's open and people listen and you can raise such concerns. As an employer, you never have to have all the answers. In the same way, no mental health professional has to have all the answers. That's why there's so many different kinds.
Yeah, I say to my students at school all the time, sometimes if I'm walking around the classroom and I can see them like sort of sulking or with their head on their desk, and I'm like, hey, what's the deal? And they're like, I don't like it because I'm not good at it. And I'm like, okay, look, it's fine not to be good at something. It's okay not to be doing well, but it's not okay if you're not trying. Like, that's where I can't forgive. Like, that's what I can't get on with, is if you don't at least give it a go. And normally that works to get them back on track. But it's the same. It's exactly the same concept and exactly the same principle. Like, it's totally fine if you don't know what to do or what to say. But the important thing is that you try to educate yourself. You ask, you support somebody and listen without judgment. If someone comes to you and says, hey, like, I'm not quite sure how to speak to this person, and you have a better understanding of mental health than they do, it's everyone's responsibility to look after each other, particularly in the workplace, but I think worldwide, globally, universally, right. One of those words.
Absolutely. Simply enough, it's just something you can't opt out of. Mental health and the need to maintain and improve it is everywhere. It's all around us. So the final stat I wanted to bring in was a specific example of how stress can affect people in the workplace and to what an extent that happens in just one organization. There can be a pressure, particularly within mental health professions or health professions in general, to cover up illness because of this archaic binary nonsense of, I can't look after somebody ill unless I'm completely healthy. And of course, that's not the case. There's plenty of people working in mental health who have experience of mental illness, but also have ongoing physical health conditions. I've got a statistic here from the NHS who reported since 2014, 91,000 members of staff have taken at least a month off work due to stress. So that is
wow.
A massive number. And again, note there, they've taken off at least a month. So that's So that's quite a substantial amount of time. The level of time off, if we were to lower that to a day or more, would be even more staggering. The other thing I wanted to do to assist you on your maths, Annie, is I worked out what 91,000 NHS staff taking a month off work looks like in terms of years.
Oh, wow.
And it's 7,583 years.
Oh, my goodness. Ugh.
So particularly in our current political climate, there's a lot of pressure on the NHS and there's a lot of concerns about its ability to resource. When we're losing literally thousands of years worth of employee time because of the stress levels, it tells me that there's plenty that could be improved within the workplace to actually make the current resources go further. I'm not saying that they aren't stretched, but there's so many additional ways that better support for mental health in the workplace could support even organisations like the NHS, where you'd assume they've got their mental health support down. There's actually a lot of support that could be improved upon.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely, particularly with the NHS. I think it makes me wonder, I'm sure that working for the NHS and for emergency services is always stressful, but it's interesting that that figure is so shockingly high since 2014. I think the NHS has been under immense pressure since 2014. I mean, I'm sure it's been under immense pressure even before then, I remember when I was at uni, I would have been at uni in 2011. I remember they were trying to close hospitals near to where I live. So they've been under immense pressure for a while. But it's interesting that that number is so high, considering the political stuff and the financial stuff that's going on with the NHS and has been going on for the last 10 years or so. Curious, isn't it?
Yeah, it's almost tiring just thinking about how much work there is to be done, but I'm really glad that in our own small way we are contributing to the conversation.
Absolutely.
And I'm really pleased to be covering this topic, because mental health in the workplace has gone ignored in far too many businesses for far too long. So I'm delighted to be part of that change. And also, we're featuring a guest today who's very much part of that change. So she is from Time to Change, a wonderful organisation we've featured before. And actually, this is a repeat guest, Emma Marks. So she is an absolute delight. She's previously been on an episode with us all about reducing stigma. So I'm delighted to have her back on again to share even more insight and give us an idea of all the wonderful resources that Time to Change have already created to work towards better mental health support in the workplace. We'll get into that interview in just a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm Emma. Talking about my mental health journey, I suppose the first time I got involved with kind of thinking that something was seriously not right was when I was 25 and I had a breakdown where I basically, there was a lot of different pressures on me and I lost the plot a bit in terms of I felt I was, my whole personality had totally crumbled and I had quite what I call psychotic experiences. So I felt I was being possessed by a monster and was just very, just my whole world fell apart really. I was living in London at the time. My mum came and rescued me from London and I went back home and it took me a good couple of years really to get to a stage where I felt I was relatively back to my kind of core self in terms of my confidence and self-awareness of what I've been through. And then following on from that, I basically have had several relapses, I suppose, with severe depression. And I was having quite a few relapses in quite a cyclical manner. And it was only when I went into secondary services after I'd had quite a serious suicide attempt that actually there was a pattern around me coming off antidepressants and my period of being really severely unwell. And it's only since I've maintained a low dosage of antidepressants that was really key in maintaining me at a level, even though I have kind of been kind of wobbly and unwell since then. I had a period of very severe anxiety at one stage, but over the last, I'd say kind of 5-6 years, my mental health has been really good. I've really worked at that. I've worked really hard and I work, it's a daily thing, like kind of your physical health. And you know, if you've had like a heart attack or diabetes or whatever, you have to kind of do the things to maintain your wellness. And for me, I think once you've kind of been down a really severe mental health route, I think it's really important that you prioritize your own tools and techniques.
I really like the way you linked it to diabetes there, because my understanding of that is that whilst it can be a very severe condition, it's one also where, as long as you manage it properly, then you can live a perfectly normal life.
Yes.
And that's very much the way I feel about mental health, because the more guests I talk to, the more I see how it's actually a very blurry line between mental health and mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. It's not that it's not binary, people might think.
Yeah.
And so in the same way with something like diabetes, you can live a perfectly normal life with it, but then
changing your medication suddenly can have a huge impact.
Mm-hmm.
Not doing the things you need to do to look after yourself mm-hmm. can have a huge impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also I think it can affect different people differently, like diabetes can. Mm-hmm. I like to use it, especially in a kind of anti-stigma context. I think it's a nice kind of analogy. But I suppose the difference, and I think having done a lot of anti-stigma work, I think the difference is, I think it's also important to appreciate that mental health will affect your behaviour and your emotions, which diabetes will as well, obviously, but I think not as impactful as mental health. So whilst there is that comparison, which is really useful in terms of stigma, I think there's also an added challenge in terms of how it affects our behaviour and relationships and things like that.
Right. In that way, it's a funny contrast to physical health conditions, because whilst I know about many mental health conditions, I know about very few physical health conditions in comparison,
yeah.
because there's so many.
Yeah.
Yet, I think with mental health, it can take so many forms depending on the person, depending on their age, their lifestyle, whatever that is, mm-hmm. in a way that having like a physical injury or physical impairments is a lot more straightforward.
Yes. Yeah, no, definitely.
And so when you talked about your experience, you started off at 25 and you'd had this breakdown. Was there anything that led up to that?
Yes, I'd had a promotion at work, and my boss at the time who was quite a strange guy, gave me a terrible reference for this promotion. I think it was a bit jealousy there because it was a management job.
Mm-hmm.
And he said I didn't have enough experience. And that kind of caused a real crisis in confidence. It just kind of triggered something within me, I think, as well as I was going to be moving out the area and lots of other stresses. Also, I was taking drugs as well, like recreational drugs, which probably didn't help. I don't think they were the cause, but I think it just didn't help. And I do think this is interesting, and I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts were. Also, within my team that I was working in at the time, there had been another woman who'd had a breakdown, and I'd met her and she seemed so together and so, you know, professional, and it was really quite shocking to me. And it was almost as if unconsciously having a breakdown was a way out of my situation, because things just didn't make sense to me. And I think, you know, that was another, I mean, I don't know how much of an impact it had, but I do know that I was not sleeping for weeks and weeks on end. And it was all kind of gearing up to the first day I started my new job. And so for 4 weeks running up to it, I wasn't sleeping. My friend said, oh, why don't you go to the doctor's and get some sleeping tablets? So I went to the doctor, but the GP wasn't very helpful, but just gave me sleeping tablets. Then I rang my mum and told her, and this is really interesting in terms of stigma, because my mum went completely mad, to call your phrase, and she basically said, you're not that kind of person, you're not weak, what are you doing, trush them down the loo, this is ridiculous, pull yourself together, da, 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 all those kind of cliched stuff. And so I did. I threw them down the loo, and sure enough, things just got worse. And when I tried to get some more sleeping tablets, the doctor was really unsympathetic and just said, how dare you not take them? And, you know, how does that make me look as a doctor? Like, da, 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 you're really undermining me. And I was really at a kind of very wobbly state at that point. And if he'd have had a bit more understanding of mental health, I think at that stage, there could have been a really helpful intervention, you know, but unfortunately there wasn't. And so I ended up just basically feeling insane. Something just broke in me, really. And that's why I think the breakdown is quite a good phrase, because it did feel like something just broke and I'd lost myself, really.
It intrigued me the way you talked about that colleague of yours,
yes.
who had gone through something similar, and she seemed so together
yeah.
before that.
Yes.
It's yeah. something that I can relate to a lot, because I feel like the worse my mental health is, the more pressure I feel to put on a mask.
Right.
And yes. so if I'm having like an okay day and then something frustrating happens, I'll soldier on with that day. Whereas mm-hmm. if I'm having a really bad mental health day, then I may not be showing my face at all.
Right.
I'll find a way to get out of plans.
Yes, yes.
Or I might know I'm going that way, so I'll take a day off preemptively. And so it's funny this way that people can almost overcompensate.
Yes.
And I feel like that partly is to do with stigma.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't imagine not going to work because of having a broken arm, because you go to work and everyone signs your cast and everyone makes a fuss of you.
Yeah.
And that actually sounds quite nice.
Yes.
For your healing process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas if I went to work and I was like, oh guys, you know, don't talk to me today. I'm super depressive. It's not a good day.
Yeah.
I don't imagine I'd be received with the same symptoms.
You'd probably get some strange
even by the most understanding people, there wouldn't be the same sort of collective running in for support.
Yeah.
And I know that that's something that is getting better, but I feel like that's definitely a factor in why we feel the need to cover up mental illness.
Yes.
And seem like we have everything together.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. And I think I had a lot of, you know, self-stigma around it. And I think that came from my mum, because my mum's a very strong woman, has come from a, you know, very difficult background, and she's brought up as a load of us and been through the mill. And I've been brought up, you know, to be a strong woman and have a good professional career and things. And that's kind of a badge of honour, I think, that my mum and myself war, and I was always seen as the strong person, and my friends would be the one they'd come to. I'd be the wise kind of strong person. And for me, it was more self-stigma. It took me a long time to get my head around the fact that I needed other people and other people's support, that I couldn't just do it myself, you know, because I suppose what was ingrained in me was, if you can't do it by yourself, then you're not good enough, or you're not strong enough, or you're hopeless, all of which I think are really toxic, kind of that kind of toxic kind of mental chatter that you have in your head. And it was only through my experiences and through the work that I've done, really, that have kind of reinforced those positive messages around how important it is to show your vulnerability, to be authentic and honest about how you're feeling, and that that's okay. And actually, that kind of vulnerability actually provides an opportunity to make some really wonderful connections with people that you wouldn't have had before, because you're kind of isolating yourself in a way that you don't realise you're isolating yourself. Very much from what you're saying about going to work and things, that, you know, we all have a work face and we all have a front, don't we? And I think if people are given permission to talk about their own mental health, then we can have a more supportive and more real environment, which actually I think would be really constructive for the workplace environment, because when people feel safer and more comfortable, they're able to perform better. And I think the message is getting across to employers that actually it makes business sense, as well as it's a nice thing to do, you know, that if you create an environment where people feel a lot more comfortable talking about their mental health, then you're going to have lesser HR issues.
Right, because it's interesting in contrast that for me, I am an employer, and I don't really buy that employers don't know when their staff are going through issues. Okay. They may not know it's a mental illness, but they generally know if there's something happening outside the workplace. You can, when you're around somebody maybe 5 days a week, and you're in charge of their workload and making sure they get their job done, I don't really get how you would miss any potential drops in productivity or changes in their mood or things that could potentially be symptoms or factors.
Mm.
And maybe it's partly that I'm a bit more empathic than some people. But it's one of those things that I think there's so many changes that need to happen, but there's also changes in terms of the workplace support as well, that not only do people need to feel more empowered to get support in the workplace, but also there needs to be the support there for them.
Yes.
Whether that's, you know, mental health first aiders, people like Natasha Devon are pushing for, whether that's increased training for managers. I wonder to what extent managers not intervening is partly because they don't know what to do.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I worked with the police doing resilience training, and well, it wasn't just the police, it was what we call blue light services, so it was ambulance, police and fire. And a lot of the management there when we discussed things around about talking about mental health, they were saying, like, we don't want to get into that because we don't want to get into trouble. We don't want to say the wrong thing. We don't want to kind of open up a can of worms. And we don't want to kind of... So there's a lot of fear, I think, from managers that A, it's mental health is messy, and B, that I think managers also feel a sense of having to be a mental health expert and not really appreciating that you don't have to be an expert, you just have to be a bit more human and actually just listen. Talking to managers after that, I think that reassured people a bit. I mean, I don't, you know, there's a lot of ill health within those services, so it's not the be-all and end-all, because I think, you know, you're working in very stressful environments and there's only so much anti-stigma stuff can do. I think it's an environment thing as well. But I do think that there is that fear of kind of saying the wrong thing and, you know, getting into trouble with HR. Or the other fear is, oh, you open up a can of worms and then they're going to be off sick for ages. There's a misunderstanding. It's like, oh, if we don't talk about it, it'll go away. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that's going on, but I really don't feel comfortable tackling it in any way whatsoever. So hopefully they'll just sort it out themselves.
Wishful thinking.
Yeah.
And I can sort of understand that, but it actually doesn't take that much, I don't think, to provide good support. And from what I do know about it, there's not a huge amount of harm you can generally do by listening.
Mm.
I think as a manager, there is a lot of pressure to have all the answers. But actually, I respect a manager far more that will tell me, oh, I don't know, let me find out and get back to you, than them try and make something up on the spot. Because generally, you can tell if you know them even a little bit.
Yes.
Actually, there's a lot of great services out there. So my first ever experience of counselling was through a previous employer, HSBC.
Right.
And that was something that I just had to email someone about, and it was all set up really quickly.
Right.
And my manager never even had to be involved in
that.
I don't know to this day if they ever even knew.
Right.
It's just I had to email a department in London, they got it sorted. That was really good, where I got to be proactive with that and get some support, and it was all paid for by the company
and
confidential and everything else that you want.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think it's not good enough, definitely. But I think there has to be, and it sounds like there was, from your experience, senior management buy-in. So it has to come from the top, because you have to make systems and environments accessible for those things that help, that create the space. And that can involve a whole package of different things. One thing that employers can do to make their environments a lot more mental health friendly is sign the Time to Change Employers Pledge. So the pledge is a 7-point action plan that employers of any size can sign up to. And within those 7 actions, one of the key ones is senior management buy-in. There's a whole list of other actions that create a mental health friendly environment. And what's good about it as well is that it's an active document, and there's an action plan to go with it. And it will only be endorsed if Time to Change Employers team see the action plan and feedback, and people concerned with the pledge are responsive to that feedback. So it is a really good first step for employees who are finding it difficult to know how to be more mental health friendly, have a more mental health friendly environment. If anybody's interested in that, if you just go to the Time to Change website and look at under employees, there will be a link where you can get some more information.
Great.
So, yeah.
I like what you said there about the importance of senior management buy-in as well.
Yes.
Because that definitely made a difference in my decision-making, accessing support through my employer at the time, because it was sort of preemptive the way they'd done it. So it was something that anyone in the organisation all around the world could access. So I didn't feel then that I was putting any personal burden on them.
Right.
Whereas if it wasn't preemptive, if I'd had to go to a manager and be like, oh, I think I need this support, can you set something up?
Yes.
Then I'd feel a lot more that I was troubling them.
Sure.
Whereas the fact that HSBC had a contract with this outside service provider, they paid a certain amount. It wasn't the same as me just personally costing them money. It was part of a whole scheme.
It didn't feel so personal. It felt more kind of,
And actually the fact that it was technically one of my employee benefits helps to kind of reframe the focus on here's something positive and proactive you can do. And I think that's a really positive way of putting it as well. But then I thought, oh, well, I'm entitled to it. It's an employee benefit.
No, that's great. That's great to hear. Yes, I mean, my mind have a similar thing where we have access 24 hours a day to external support, counselling, and we can book in sessions if we want. And we there's a whole load of benefits. And I do think there's something, I think you're right, there's something about having ease of access and not having to go through your manager that I think makes it feel a lot less onerous and a lot easier to access.
For sure. And so with your own experience then, what do you think could have been different in terms of potentially their approach or what your colleagues did?
Actually, at that time, I don't think there was, because I think it was quite a unique first-time experience for me. But because I think actually the staff were really good when I was, because I'd actually moved area, and I was actually really shocked about how sympathetic they were actually, in terms of, because I just wanted them to sack me, you know, because I just didn't want anything more to do with it. But I think because they were a charity, I think they had some understanding of mental health. It was working for a learning disabilities charity, but people in there had an understanding of mental health. They actually were quite good. Some of the good practices about kind of making sure you have regular contact and ring up, but check people are okay, not kind of pressurising people into coming back, you know, and so they did all those things really, and in the end I did resign. But it was quite difficult for them because I'd moved back from my parents in Birmingham and that was in London. So they could only have a certain level of contact. And because it had happened so suddenly and I was working part-time in another unit before I was going to be transferred, it wasn't as if, and it was a shift work and residential, so it wasn't as if I was in there 9 to 5 and people might have been able to spot symptoms or see a change in my behaviour or anything like that, because I'd only worked there part-time and did overnights and did a couple of days, and the people you were kind of shifts in the night in terms of the people you saw. So in terms of that workplace, you know, looking back, I actually don't think there was much that they could have done. But for other workplaces that I've been involved in, there has definitely been things that if only they'd have done this or that, then I wouldn't have been off for so long, that kind of thing, or I wouldn't have gone off in the first place, actually. That's the other thing I think would have been really helpful to me. I think in terms of thinking about in the workplace, the kind of the things that actually really make a difference if you are off sick, you know, if you're off sick with cancer or any other kind of physical health issue, you'll expect probably a card or some flowers from work, but when it's a mental health thing, you don't expect that. Well, you don't get it really.
Right.
So that's kind of one of the things where I think there's a lack of parity around mental health and physical health. But one of the things that really helped me in terms of when I was quite, what I'd say, wobbly, I like the word wobbly. It was when I was at work and me and my partner had split up, and she just left me very quickly. It was all quite full on. I was very upset, obviously. We'd been living together and everything. My manager was very supportive, and so I was able to work from home, which really helped. And I had, you know, worked shorter days over a couple of weeks. And that just stopped me from just diving down, because my friends were really concerned that I'd kind of dive down because I'd had lots of previous episodes. But by kind of providing that kind of safety net of working from home, doing shorter hours, I really do think that was really helpful in preventing me from going off. You know, when I've been unwell, I've been off for like 6 months. So I think things like that can be really, you know, having that flexibility. And what I did with, before I started with that employer, I did a wellbeing action plan. So a wellbeing action plan will look at somebody who's experienced mental health problems. That can be really helpful. There'll be lots of different questions on them. Mind has one that you can just download. for free. But and the one that I had, there's things like what are the things that will kind of be triggers for your mental health? What are the things that, you know, will make you feel, you know, are the things you want to tell us about those things? What can we do when you're feeling like that? Because for some people, you know, as you said, we all react differently. For some people, if they're feeling low, all they want to do is kind of be left alone. But for others, actually, people want to feel like there's people around them and want to have conversations. So it's an individual thing. So that's what I liked about the action plans. It's individual. What can we do to help you? It's a really good kind of question to ask. And what are the signs, you know? So for me, it's kind of isolating myself, not talking as much, not, you know, all those kind of things. And also, what would be helpful? And again, it was working from home, having shorter days, those kind of things. And that, I think, was so helpful for me in comparison to starting a new job at another place. And there was a risk assessment before I went in. And so it's all about kind of managing risk of your health. And I just found that really unhelpful. And actually, this was a mental health charity, so I'm not going to say who it was. So that was, you know, quite shocking for me, actually. In actual fact, that changed it, because I did actually raise it as an issue. But that the wording around risk and, you know, and all that was actually really unhelpful. So now they've got wellbeing action plans, which is great. It's so important, I think, these things in employment, to actually kind of turn it on its head. It's actually about, actually, what can we do to help? What can we do to be more supportive? Actually, can, you know, really make the difference between somebody kind of having a wobble and somebody going off full-blown sick for 6 months, you know.
I think that's really important. And it shows the power of ultimately just making a very small change in perspective. Whether it's a risk assessment or a wellbeing action plan, it's similar questions, I would imagine. It's for a similar reason, but it's just having a more positive onus,
yes,
and therefore you feel like the organisation is coming to you and coming to you with help and help you, rather than calling you in for a serious meeting about, are you a risk to the organisation?
Yes.
And that's something that I think there's a bit of a parallel. We've both talked about how organisations can be proactive in the resources they put in place for dealing with mental health. And so something I would add to that as well, in terms of having this positive rather than negative focus on how we tackle mental health issues in the workplace, is that I find it incredibly rewarding giving that kind of support to my team. And for me, I think it's partly that I'm self-employed, and therefore I get to be involved in a broader range of managerial activities. But for me, that increasingly is a massive part of why I love having a team, is being able to give a broader support, not just I'm helping you pay your bills, or I'm giving you something to do between 10 and 6. It's also something where being involved with each person as an individual, and how can we build your career? How can we improve your skills, your confidence, whatever that is really important to me. And that's increasingly a big thing that motivates me. As opposed to, you know, performance of a team, it's like every single individual's performance matters to me. And it's incredible how even the smallest things can make a difference, whether it's someone saying, oh, the buses are really bad at this time of day. So I'll say, okay, well, if you came in an hour later and just did your shifts an hour later, would that make a difference? And we'll try it, and it will. And potentially, if that's saving them half an hour a day, then that's 2.5 hours that I've given them back from their week. And I've not had to give any money away for that. I've not had to put anything new in place. It's just changing their shifts. For me, it's really important to understand that if there's anything going on at home with my team, if there's anything going on in terms of mental or physical health, because I care about supporting them in that way. And so that's something I'd really want to encourage anyone that's an employer or is in any kind of management listening to this to think about, is actually how rewarding it can be to give that kind of support. And the level to which you'll understand your team better will no doubt really help. Because if nothing else, if you have a genuine connection with them, they'll be working not only to do their job, but also to support you. We don't go to work to support the brand. We go to work to support the team, to support, you know, the managers. we see if they're stressed, they see if we're stressed.
Yeah. It creates a much healthier culture within the workplace. I think having that, it's great hearing your perspective as an employer, because, you know, employers, if they're decent enough people, don't want to have to kind of be punitive or have a kind of atmosphere like that. And I think it's just that they either that's the way the system's always been and that's the way we do things kind of attitude, or they don't see an alternative way that will kind of be constructive. And I think, do you have any reasonable adjustments? You know, because that links to the Disability Discrimination Act, and so it's all about kind of litigation and risk, and, you know, and it's so kind of just actually saying that, do I have any reasonable adjustments, rather than saying, well, what can we do to make things better? It's a much more engaging kind of way of working with people. Like you say, words can be really important, and I think employers don't have to make massive changes, you know, in order to make a really significant difference to people.
Sure, it can be really small, and a lot of these things are quite universal good management, like you mentioned earlier about when someone's off sick, not putting pressure on them to come back to work. And on the face of it, that might seem a bit ironic because you want them to come back to work, but actually, particularly when it comes to any mental health conditions they're dealing with, putting pressure on them is going to add to that, whereas actually you can still apply sort of pressure in a positive way by being like, oh, I'm looking forward to you coming back to work.
The team
is missing you. There's things that you can say which make them feel part of something that they're missing out, as opposed to being like, you're skiving off, you shouldn't be at home. And I've known of friends of mine that have had that experience where managers have been on the phone to them while they've been off and said, oh, this could affect your record. I'll be sending this across to HR, or this language that's very negative. And that's why I hear about it, because then they have to rant to their friend about it.
Yes, it's just that kind of how you communicate with people in a humane manner, I think, an open and honest manner as well. I think it's important to be honest. Obviously, the employers want you back, but I think you can still have an open and honest conversation without it being a punitive one. And, you know, and also I think communication is really important, because I always remember when I was off sick and a letter coming through the door saying that my pay was going to be reduced, because that you have like a certain level of time of sick and then it goes to like half pay. And I was in quite a difficult financial situation at the time. And to get that letter through the door without kind of having a phone call, but I was living by myself, and then having this through the door, it actually really had an impact on my mental health. And it's things like that, just little things that like people just don't think about that.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we are coming near the end of our time for this topic. So
it's gone so quick.
So I'd just like to wrap up by saying really that this is part of the reason why you're a great guest for this topic, is because Time to Change, the charity you work for, has so many resources, whether it's the employer's pledge, but also there's a lot that employees can do. So even if you aren't in any kind of managerial or authoritative position at work, there are still resources you can find through Time to Change to become an individual champion yourself.
Yes, a community champion, yeah.
But also there's posters you can put up at your workplace. There's ways that you can start changing that culture. And it's nice that there's campaigns like Time to Change there that will provide you with a lot of the resources, a lot of the statistics to back up why this works, because ultimately looking after the mental health of your employees is financial sense for organisations.
It does make good.
It's not just about happy employees, everyone benefits, including the shareholders.
Yes, that's true. And so you can sign up as an employee champion, but you can also sign up as a community champion. And at the moment, there will, if you're interested, because the Time to Talk Day is coming up in February, which is always the first Thursday in February, and that's a national campaign that gives people an opportunity just to open up the conversation about mental health. And if you're quick off the mark, you can go on the website and get a chatterbox which has a whole load of resources in there. You have to sign up because there's only a limited amount, but it has like flyers, it has leaflets, it has, I think there was tea bags last year. I think there's going to be tea bags as well. So it's about having a cuppa in the chat. So that's something to look out for. But as you've said, there's also lots of blogs and videos, and there's a whole wealth of information and resources on there. You could spend a day actually kind of going through all the stuff. But yes, I'd really encourage you if it's something that you're passionate about and interested in terms of anti-stigma around mental health, do have a look at the Time to Change website.
For sure. And it frequently doesn't really take that much. I'm reminded of Macmillan Coffee Mornings. I've been part of one of those before, and I was surprised by how many people started talking to me about cancer.
Right.
And
yeah.
My only experience in that is with grandparents that were too far on or too elderly for treatment.
Right.
So I don't really feel like I do have a lot of experience of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the fact that there was this fundraising event all across the country people thought, oh, this is our opportunity.
Yes, definitely.
So I don't think we can anticipate how much just showing up for mental health can mean people feel comfortable talking about it and starting those conversations.
Yes, very much so. It's giving permission to have those conversations and giving a space. When you have a national campaign and you have all the resources with it, it kind of makes things a lot easier and starting those conversations.
Yeah, it's a good excuse.
Yes.
All right, so we'll wrap up there. I will put some links for some of the Time to Change resources we've talked about in the description for the episode. Thank you so much for being part of the episode today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
One thing we didn't mention in the episode is the Champions of Time to Change podcast. This is a show all about the great work Time to Change do and what it means to be one of their champions. Also, if you go ahead and subscribe to the show on SoundCloud, you can look out for an upcoming episode where Annie and I are guests. I'll put the links to go listen to their podcast in the description for this episode. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.